So I'm going to give you a overview of the conceptual ideas that led up over 50 years from the posing of the two-black hole, two-body problem in general relativity in 1935 through about 1985, where it really transitioned into a full-fledged field. And then most of the rest of your talks are going to be what happened since then. This was a lot of fun for me. I noticed looking around the room that roughly two-thirds of the room probably wasn't actively involved in this problem in 1975. And so some of you may be a little less clear about the shoulders of the giants that we stood on, who took the equations themselves and turned them into a soluble environment for us to try using computers on. So I thought I'd go back through that. I spent a lot of time in the archives getting this material, and then also making them accessible to people over the web by converting them into digital form and putting them into my PowerPoints. I think it's very fitting, of course, that we're having this meeting just after Time magazine named Albert Einstein the person of the century. That's a pretty profound point. There are a lot of important people this century. A lot of the world was transformed by people this century. And the fact that Albert Einstein, when it's all said and done, is considered to be the most important person of the century, and the fact that this problem that we're all working on is, I think, arguably the most important problem that was posed by Einstein in general relativity, gives one a little bit of pause when you think about the importance of the field you're working in. It really took the entire century. In the 1910s, we saw the general theory of relativity actually formulated, its first solution by Schwarzschild, the spherical solution we now know as the spherical black hole. The very first work on how equations of motion derived from the field equations was Einstein and Grömer in late 20s. In the 30s, Einstein and Rosen actually posed the topological two-body problem. And I'll be going through a lot of this in detail. In the 40s, Lichnerowicz and then Ivan Shoky-Berhua, who we have here with us, posed the Cauchy problem, both the initial data and the evolution problem. In the 50s, numerical relativity as we know it today was conceived. I'm thrilled that Charlie Misner is here because he and Bryce DeWitt were the two people who quite crisply posed the problem, and I'll be going back and talking through their papers on that. In the 60s, with Charlie and Wheeler posing geometric dynamics, that's really the work that I think set this whole field in motion. And their students, like Lindquist, working with Susan Hahn, began to take the notion of numerical relativity and apply it. In the 70s, a lot more of the theoretical structure were worked out. People like Jimmy York were key in that. And the real space-time was worked, roughed out, I guess I'd call it, by people like myself and Epley. In the 80s, the students from that effort really exploded into a field, and we finally got some traction in keeping them from disappearing into the bomb labs and actually going into universities. And then the 90s, the head-on problem was actually now reduced to essentially something you can solve to arbitrary accuracy. 3D dynamics started. And in the next decade, I believe you're going to see the 3D dynamics actually made to become an accurate solver for the Einstein equations. And hopefully we're going to see the birth of gravity wave astronomy. Now, when I give talks, as I'll do in the physics colloquium tomorrow at 4, about computational science in general, I try to get across to people who think about computational science as the new idea field, where if it's, you know, if it's 6 months old, you know, it's you don't have to think about it anymore, and try to get them to understand that in computational science, big problems take a century. Because you have to conceptually work them out before you can numerically work them out. And it's a much longer process than most people think, particularly people that are working in the field. So why did I, as a graduate student in 1972, a second-year graduate student, decide to throw myself into what Saul and Bill Press at Les Ouches called a swamp? They felt that it was most likely that I would step into this water and disappear from sight and never be heard from again. Because it was a really complex area, it wasn't clear that we could, in fact, solve the problem in a thesis time scale. The reason I got into general relativity at all, which was in 69, was from reading the book Geometrodynamics and the fundamental visionary papers of Wheeler, Misner, Brill, and others, and understanding that the topological and differential metric dynamics of space and time was a rich phenomenological zoo, and that there was a great deal to be learned by looking at the vacuum field equations and understanding their properties. Well, because of Einstein and Rosen, the fundamental two-body problem in gravitation, which is about as fundamental a problem in science as there is, was posable within a geometrodynamical context. And Einstein and then DeWitt and others realized that this was the way you'd go about solving the two-body problem. There was the early days of the singularity theorems, cosmic censorship, and the question is, what would happen in this highly nonlinear dynamic regime when two black holes collided? Could you lead to a naked singularity? Thorne, of course, was organizing lots of people to calculate gravitational radiation because at that time, Weber had said that he had seen gravitational waves, and so there was a real sense that we were right on the frontier of an observable science. And of course, we now know that was many, many orders of magnitude off. And then Hawking had just begun the area theorem. But there was a real sense that the two black hole collision would be one of the great sources of gravitational radiation, therefore is important to look at. We felt that supercomputers, which of course have always been an exponential, I'll come back and show you precisely about that in a minute, were just beginning to get fast enough that maybe you could do the head-on collision problem, because that's the way exponentials work. They cross repeatedly through thresholds. And when you go through a threshold, what had previously been impossible now becomes routine. That's the nature of exponentials. And so it was thought that maybe supercomputers were on the edge. But mainly, I needed a PhD. And Bryce DeWitt was my PhD advisor, and he thought this was what I should work on. And I said, this will be pretty easy. We ought to be able to get this gravitational radiation by Christmas. And that was the summer of 72. One of the things that made it possible, and I want to stress this, wasn't the computers. In fact, almost everything I'll tell you about it isn't the computers that are important. It's the conceptual theoretical framework that's important. And remember, this is 72. Only 9 years earlier, the Kerr metric had just been discovered, the first time since 1918, an additional characteristic of the black hole understood. The term and the conceptual framework of this as an object, an actual black hole, that term was in 1968, was coined by John Archibald Wheeler, an American scientist. And the Les Ouches Summer School, which was incredibly important for bringing so many of the young people at that time together, was focused largely because of people like Stephen Hawking on the notion of the collision. And this is, in many of these cases, what I've done is I've gone back to the literature, scanned and used Photoshop and so forth in my basement to my home to actually digitize these things and make them more widely available to people. So this is actually just right out of Stephen's, out of the book from Stephen's lecture. And you can see the notion that there was not only the coalescence that was going to go on, but the distinctions between apparent horizons, which were discontinuous and jumped, and the event horizons, and the fact that there were going to be cusps on the event horizons This was all very clear to Stephen in 1972. So we had the conceptual space-time, and what we really needed to do, in fact, we had topologically the space-time. What we needed was the time-dependent metric structure on that space-time. Again, I think most of you, particularly you young folks, don't appreciate just how unknown this area was. So here's what Roger Penrose had to say in the year later, namely that these considerations have little to say about large perturbations. You can envision two black holes coming in and spiraling in. And do we have any reason other than wistful thinking to think that the end result, the end state, will be a black hole and not a naked singularity? And of course, this was at the moment that they were still trying to understand, was the Kerr metric stable? Saul and a lot of the other people had been doing perturbation analysis of that. But the question was very open at that time. And so I remember Roger saying to me, Larry, we're very interested in your problem because the most likely thing to break open a black hole would be to drop another one on it. And so we're very interested in your computer code to see if that could happen. Now, of course, we were doing, and all I will talk about, is the head-on collision. And in that case, you don't have much of the impact of angular momentum, either spin or orbital angular momentum. And that, of course, is, in the case of the Kerr, one of the things that might lead to a naked singularity. So even the head-on case wouldn't be conclusive if, in fact, there was not a naked singularity formed. Now, the thing that I found particularly remarkable is when I wrote my book on supercomputing, I went back and surveyed, maybe 1,000 different papers in the literature of problems in science that use supercomputers. But I also went back over the technology of, you know, our tools, basically, as scientists, namely, in this case, supercomputers. And so here you have, from 1940 through 2000, basically the fastest computer available and how many floating point operations per second it's capable of. And you can see that while there has been a sort of exponential growth, there was a tapering off here because essentially all of these are single processor machines. And it was really not until the Iliac 4 innovated the notion of parallel computing, which was a 64 processor system, and the Cray 1 innovated the notion of vector processors, that you were able to get back on this growth curve, which has gone back up to a teraflop now. Notice also what these machines are made of: relays, vacuum tubes, transistors, integrated circuits, and now microprocessors. So what about our particular problem? Well, as I'll get to in a second, Lishnarevich posed the evolution problem in 1944 during the war in Paris. And at that time, this was the pre-vacuum tube form of computers. When DeWitt got a job after he got his PhD at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, he worked, for instance, on developing codes for the atomic cannon, which most of you probably don't remember. But it was a very long cannon that we shot. We're going to shoot nuclear weapons on the battlefield with. And so he was actually one of the major developers of what we now call Lagrangian hydrodynamics. And in fact, when he did that, Edward Teller was so enthused by this new breakthrough, he called a lab-wide meeting for Bryce to explain in his elegant way Lagrangian hydrodynamic methods to these folks. And so this was when Bryce understood the power of digital computers to solve the laws of physics. That was, of course, again, at a time when you had vacuum tube computers. Then Wright-Patterson held the seminal, probably, meeting in our field in 1957. Charlie Misner was there, and I'll come back to what he had to say in a minute. Of course, as I'm trying to show you, moving up the power curve. Hahn and Lindquist, when they did their very first evolution of the two black hole problem, were using the new all transistorized IBM 7090. So this was, the stretch computer, you may remember, was the first all transistorized computer. So you can imagine how hanging 10 leading edge Lindquist thought he was. I mean, here you are with the first all transistorized computer, and you're actually solving the full Einstein, nonlinear Einstein equations for the two-body problem numerically. Okay, I think he must have felt, and Charlie, you were there, about as leading edge as we feel today. I mean, it was a big transition. Then there were a series of what I call the DeWitt era of PhD theses under Chavez, myself, and Epley that really brought this problem to a practical state. And after that, we have what I term the modern era. So one of the things I want you to notice is that this problem went from about one flop to about 100 million flops just to get to the point that we could actually get the space-time worked out. Since then, it's gone up by another factor of at least 10,000. So let's look at it specifically. If we go back to Hahn and Lindquist in 1963, they worked, and this is in Annals of Physics, they took Misner's initial data and Misner's initial coordinates and used the 7090, ran for 3 hours, which at that time was a long time to run on a science problem. It was a single processor machine, about 200 kiloflops. In 1977, when Epley and I were at Livermore, we were running on the 7600, which is a wonderful supercomputer. But one processor, it was about 35 megaflops, ran about 5 hours. So we were running, our problem ran about 300x, considering both the time that was longer and the machine was faster. This is an image from the recent run that Seidel, Soon, and a number of the rest of you here worked on at NCSA, where we gave for 2 weeks our 256 origin to this team. This is a grazing collision, which I'll come back to. But now you're running on 256 processors for maybe 40 hours for a single evolution, which is 30,000 times the amount of floating point operations as Epley and I did. And so that's part of why you can do 3D. Now is that you actually are able to do 30,000 times as many floating point operations. But I remind you that going back to when Lindquist was working with Wheeler and Misner back in 63, it's 9 million times the floating point operations in one evolution today as then. So when we say we're doing an evolution, they're all evolutions. They're all a space-time, okay? But the amount of floating point operations done in that evolution can vary by six orders of magnitude as I go through this history. So I'm going to break down this into a variety of chunks. We're going to talk about the Cauchy evolution. We're going to talk about the initial data. We're going to talk about the two black hole problem itself. We're going to talk about the gravitational radiation. So in each of these, what I tried to do, and I apologize ahead of time for those of you who have either left your article out or your favorite article out, because you know you just can't be comprehensive. What I tried to do was to particularly for the younger of you who may not have read the literature as closely, this older literature, is to try to point out to you what the chief conceptual breakthroughs were. And if you go back, then I have with me here Xeroxes of most of the articles I'll refer to. If you can't find them in the library, just come see me, and I'll be happy to let you look at them. Well, it very, very clearly, in one of the most wonderful papers in this century in relativity, Lichnerowicz laid out the whole notion in completely modern form of what we now call the 3 plus 1 decomposition and the idea of numerical integration, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Yvonne then took the initial data problem itself and formulated it essentially in the form that we used it as modified by Jimmy York. In 57, DeWitt and Misner very crisply laid out the concept of numerical relativity. This, as I said, was then embedded in this more general notion of geometric dynamics and eventually the various evolutions from different initial data and through different slicings. Those were embedded in the notion of superspace. A whole series of articles that Charlie and Arnowitt and Deser did in the canonical decomposition were very useful for understanding the constraints, the initial data problem, the evolution problem. Grosch in 1970 had a very important article on domain independence, that is, from the initial data, one is evolving forward into formal domain independence, and a lot of the things that, for instance, Doug Eardley and I looked at later were the issue of, for numerical relativity, what is the formal domain of dependence for the space-time. York, who I was one of my close co-workers in those days, did a lot of very, very beautiful work on the initial value problem that still all of which has not really been put to use, I think. But Jimmy and I worked together and created what we term space-time engineering, that is, taking the completely formal approach that Jimmy had based on Yvonne's work and really making that practical for building space-times. So let me go back to what I have to say is my favorite paper in the history of general relativity. It's in French, and with Yvonne in the room, I'm not going to try to pronounce the French because I would be embarrassed. This is just such a wonderful paper. You all should read this. He goes from just the Einstein equations itself and then breaks out the notion of using the extrinsic curvature and the intrinsic curvature of three-dimensional slices in a completely modern form, writes down the equation that Epley and I used to evolve the extrinsic curvature, studies what he terms minimal surfaces. We call them maximal surfaces now, but it depends on the embedding space, whether they're minimal or maximal, but they're extremal at least, and points out that for a zero shift vector, making a surface minimal is equivalent to the trace of the extrinsic curvature vanishing. Then he writes down the lapse equation that we solve for maximal slicing, or one's solved ever since, as an elliptic equation on the lapse, what we call the lapse now. Of course, they didn't call it that then. And he points out that in the case of zero shift vector, if one uses a maximal slicing, then the the space-time congruence of whorl lines that are normal to the foliation of the maximal slices acts as an irrotational, incompressible fluid. This physical notion of taking something as abstract as a space-time foliation and the corresponding space-time congruence orthogonal to it and thinking of it as a fluid is something that was very important. DeWitt used to use this when he talked about the maximal slices. He used to stand up and say, you just stretch the space, the slice across the space-time, and being that it's maximal in volume, it will thereby avoid singularities, because near singularities you have little volume and maximal is big volume. And so I'm trying to give you an example of sort of how this physical reasoning was critical at these times when conceptually we were sort of hanging on by our fingernails and in a very complex mathematical environment. Well, he then sets, for the initial data problem, he sets out the elliptic equation for the three metric conformal factor. He breaks out the three space as taking out a conformal factor and looking at the conformal metric as being the appropriate thing to do, which later Yvonne and then Jimmy particularly showed that the conformal three metric was the carrier of information about gravitational radiation. He then sets up the in-body problem using, unlike Einstein and Rosen, who used bridges, he used matter pockets. He sets up the time-symmetric initial data for conformally flat three-space, which is indeed what we, and for a number of years, was the main thing that was evolved. He used, oddly enough, what he didn't do was then use the notion that he should have done a maximal foliation, or he could have done a maximal foliation, even though other ways in the article he talks about doing that. And when he actually writes down the space timeline element, he still uses geodesic. And then he studies, he solves for the conformal factor in terms of the pockets of matter. And he exhibits actually what later Brill and Lindquist talk about as the interaction energy, that is for bound initially time symmetric, that is at rest and at a finite distance, two objects will have an interaction energy, and you can derive that back out. But then he has this wonderful sentence, which, Yvonne, you can correct my translation if I don't get it quite right. But he then says, okay, so then for these given initial data, effectively, there corresponds a rigorous solution to the problem, that is, to the evolution problem, in which the evolution in time is governed by these equations, which he refers back then to these evolution equations up here, and which we can then obtain this evolution in time by the numerical integration of these equations. Now, this is 1944. Okay? So it's all there. Now, of course, these giants of the field like Charlie Misner, Bryce DeWitt, Wheeler, were very aware of all this, Yvonne. And so in 57, when they had this conference, there's just really kind of a transcript. It's not even a transcript, but they had sort of summaries of it, like maybe they would have from a meeting like this. And Bryce DeWitt asked if the Cauchy problem is now sufficiently understood to be put on an electronic computer. Remember, this is 57. In the early 50s, he's running big problems on electronic computers at Livermore. Charlie says that, well, I just happen to have in my pocket here a good initial data on the two Einstein-Rosen bridges, and that these would provide a non-singular representation of the initial data. He thought that we could give the initial data so that you would get out gravitational radiation. Charlie was very clear that these two throats, as they evolved, would produce gravitational radiation in the three space. And then DeWitt talked about some of the problems that he had when you have movement. So as the holes go together and then the gravity waves go out, he was very aware of how difficult that is computationally because of his work in Lagrangian dynamics. And so he said, you know, we're going to have to think about that because you don't want the gravity waves to run off and leave your hole and you know, you've got to be, you know, working down there. So, I mean, this is so practical. I just find it so amazing. And then I think we have to give Charlie Misner the prize for the first truly crisp definition of numerical relativity. And this is a quote from that conference proceedings. And I love how he starts. Nothing changes. So anyway, he says, okay, get yourself a supercomputer and a bunch of programmers and a lot of money. And then the computer wants to know what are the values of g mu nu and its first derivative. Yvonne has told us that to get these initial conditions, you essentially take that problem and it's a separate numerical problem, okay? But what you do is it's not as big a problem as the evolution problem, so you hand it over to a smaller computer before you start what Leech-Nerovich called the evolution problem, right? And then the small computer would prepare the initial conditions for the big one. And then that there was still, of course, a very early in the existence proof days, but it would say that, you know, at least for some time, some finite time to the future, there is going to be a solution before everything blows up. So, you know, all you have to do, as Bryce said, is just difference the equations, put them on the computer, and solve the problem. And that's what he told me in 72 as a graduate student. He says, I mean, you know, what's the problem here? Note that at that moment, supercomputers were still built out of vacuum tubes. Now, this is, again, why I got into general relativity. I was just so fascinated by geometric dynamics. And, of course, one of the things I'm not going to have time to go into, I'd love to, but there'll be other talks on it, is the problem of motion. That is, the whole point to a two-body problem is that they move according to some equation of motion, and what Wheeler and the others understood, and this, as I said, goes back to the late 20s with Einstein and Krummer, is that in some sense, out of the field equations, the equations of motion for motion of particles in the field of the gravitational field should come. And this is, again, from this great paper in Reviews of Modern Physics, again, one of the truly great papers in the history of the field. But they talked about having taken this wormhole solution, which is essentially, you know, since if you just cut it here, that's the Misner-matched initial conditions that from about 1960. Anyway, the evolution and time of this three geometry can be specified, can be found by starting off with a power series expansion and thereafter by electronic computation. Remember, Wheeler is deep into the hydrogen bomb problem at this time. And so the notion of using electronic computers to solve problems at least this complex was well underway. And then the intrinsic geometry of the resulting four-space time is completely determined. by that evolution, by the Cauchy problem, regardless of the freedom of choice that's open to the coordinate system. Now, this freedom of choice that's open to the coordinate system that's used to describe that intrinsic geometry is where the whole notion of laps and shifts and different kinds of gauges come from. This geometry contains within itself the story, that is, the geometry, the time change of the three geometry and the extrinsic curvature. From within that comes this, all you need to know about the change of distance between the throats, the generation of gravitational waves as they accelerate toward each other. Very profound, totally clear understanding of the problem. It was, to me, that was the only reason it could be attacked, is because these giants had had such a clear, brilliant, you know, laser-like understanding of the problem. So we didn't have to work on that. We could work on the practical side of how you solve it. So now let's go to the initial data itself. Well, if you go back and read the PhysRev article in 35 that Einstein and Rosen wrote, they talk about, as geometrodynamics talked about, could ultimately geometrodynamics at a small scale be a model for elementary particles? And that was really a lot of the motivation, I believe, Charlie, wouldn't you agree? So there's a lot of discussion about this, as you know, and of course the other one was the unification of electromagnetism with gravity, which was, again, something that Einstein, of course, had been working on with his unified field theory, but Charlie and Wheeler, a lot of their first work was on electromagnetic fields in these wormholes. And for instance, if you had electromagnetic field threading the wormhole, then you would have the possibility of charge without charge, mass without mass. In other words, without actual matter in the field, you would still have gravitational effects. Well, so this this is what, you know, we do today. It's exactly the same data as Einstein and Rosen laid out. Lichnerowicz rethought this in terms of n-bodies. Misner then actually did the matched, that is, I'll get to that in a second, initial conditions, that is, the bottom sheet and the top sheet agree. Lindquist looked more generally at the problem. Brill and Lindquist looked at it and derived out the interaction energy between the throats. Then the Misner coordinates, as I'll get back, weren't really very appropriate for numerical computation. So Andre Schott, is one of the things he contributed was, there's essentially, because it's a conformal map, I'll come back to it in a minute, a complex conformal map, there's sort of two ways you can do it to get the coordinates. And we all still use Schottes's coordinates. And then this was all for two non-spinning Schwarzschild-like black holes that were going in an axisymmetric initial data. So there was then a whole other set of things that could be going on. They could have intrinsic spins. The spins could be aligned or not aligned. In the axisymmetric case, you could have equal or unequal holes. And in the full case that it's not axisymmetric, they could be having orbital angular momentum in the spin, and the orbital angular momentum might or might not be aligned. So a whole set of folks began to work toward the end of my time scale for this talk on that more general problem. So from Brillen, and actually, this is Hahn and Lindquist working, showing that one of the first things you had to decide was, did you want to have, if you wanted equal masses, did you want to have these matched initial conditions like Misner had developed, in which case this two-sphere here and this two-sphere here are isometric, and therefore you can join them and think of this as just the evolution of a wormhole, or did you want to leave the freedom to have these two sheets be different down below and not have a matched problem. So Hahn and Lindquist took the matched case. And it's very interesting. It's a fairly lengthy article in Annals of Physics back in 64. You see, they didn't have the notion of black hole yet. This was still 4 years in the future. So what they were really interested in were these throats and the areas of the throats collapsing and the distance between those minimal surfaces at the throats changing with time and maybe sending out light rays and so forth. Furthermore, Misner's coordinates, while they were wonderfully, as you can see, adapted around the strong field region of the holes, Because as you go out to infinity, these were essentially the equipotentials and force lines for two opposite charges, electric charges. And so as you go out, these things are not at all nice spheres, and it gets very difficult to numerically. And so a lot of their numerical problems were actually at large distances. But they used a mesh size, which is quite comparable to what Epley and I used. They used geodesic normal coordinates. They hadn't got into the maximal slicing yet. They started with holes that were essentially almost inside a common event horizon, although they didn't know that at the time. And they were only able to integrate a few tenths of an m into the future. But essentially, everything that you needed to do numerical relativity was there, and it worked. And so that was the real proof that you could go ahead and do this. Well, as I said, most of the people were still using geodesic slicing. So where did maximal slicing come from? Well, good old Leshnerovich, you know, in 1944, it's basically all there. He talks about the minimal surfaces. He talks about it as a coordinate condition for slicing a space-time. Then there was a very interesting set of uses of maximal in the early attempts to do quantum gravity and to do the canonical quantization and setting up things like energy formulas. Charlie has a great, one of my favorite papers, which was on mass and goo, G00, in which he showed that some of the early work that Komar had done wasn't quite right and sort of did some of that use. And again, maximal was used in these cases as a convenient way to sort of knock off some terms and to, make the math easier. Then Chavez, actually, as the first of these DeWitt theses, did use maximal slicing, but he used the anisometric boundary conditions, meaning that it was zero, the lapse was zero on the throats, and so there wasn't any evolution at the throats. DeWitt and a pile of us graduate students did realize we could go back to Kruskal, and I'll show you that in a second, and do the maximal slicing of the Kruskal extension, analytic extension of the Schwarzschild metric. And at the same time that we were about to send this off to FISREV, it turned out that Estabrook and Walquist, quite independently, had found an analytic way of slicing up the Kruskal spacetime. And Reinhardt the same year, right. In fact, Reinhardt, we only found out about after we'd submitted the paper. So then we were able to, this was meant as a warm-up for the two black hole, and we then used it and developed the technology for solving elliptic equations and coupling it to solving the analytic equations. And we found these very simple behavior of the lapse function, which I'll show you in a second. And so I went to Jimmy and I said, look, something this simple must have an analytic reason for it. And so Jimmy said, sharpened his pencil and thought about it for a little bit. And we came up with these nice analytic ways to understand the rate of exponential collapse of the lapse and other things. I wrote a paper on that. And then Doug Eardley and I worked on this because it was clear that, practically speaking, the maximal slicing avoided the singularities in the Schwarzschild, avoided singularities in the two black hole, and the question was, how general was that? And Doug did some really brilliant work on generalizing it, proving some theorems. At the same time, Shoke Bruha, Marsden, and Tipler, and Jimmy York all were working on this. There were crushing singularities, there were strong curvature singularities, and so there were theorems under which conditions that you could get a singularity avoidance and when you couldn't. And we were able to take, for instance, some of the dust solutions of Oppenheimer and Snyder for different kinds of profiles of the dust collapse and actually understand, practically speaking, when maximal slicing would work and when it wouldn't. So here's an example from the one black hole from my thesis. Here again is Kruskal. This is R equals 0, which is the singularity. Here is T equals 0, the initial data. The dotted line represents R equals 2m, which is the event horizon. And, of course, what you see is if you used a slicing convention of geodesics, then in pi m, you the center point of that hits the singularity. Now, the normal T equal constant Schwarzschild solution for the slicing goes up like this and, of course, goes down like this. And therefore, the lapse is anisymmetric, that is, it moves you forward in time on this side of the throat and backward in time on that side of the throat, and therefore is zero here, where there's no evolution. So this is actually a maximal slicing, but anisymmetric at the throat. Here is the maximal slicing now, and what happens is that there's an asymptotic surface, space-like surface, at r equals 3 halves m, which is r equal 3 halves m itself is an infinite cylinder. So one was able to understand that what happened is that the lapse exponentially decreased here in the center. And in fact, York was able to figure out that in 1.91 m, it actually essentially went to zero effectively. I mean, exponentially, the integration over time of the lapse times delta t to get the proper time was, as it compared to say with pi m, was a finite number. And then these would be the radial coordinates of the orthogonal trajectories. The last thing, of course, was to say, well, if you'll notice, we have what is termed grid sucking, which is that the radial coordinates in the 3 space gradually find themselves sucked down inside the horizon. And that was a real pain because a lot of your grid ended up inside the hole where it didn't help. So there were a whole class of things such as the minimal distortion shift vector that Jimmy and I looked at and other ones that people thought about, algebraic ones, that if you could use the shift to push out from the throat the radiometric, then you could keep more of your coordinates outside. So this was really a very important laboratory for us to understand what would happen with these different slicings. Now, this was from a little bit, I'll show you just a couple of things that are past 85. This is an actual isometric embedding of what happens when you do a geodesic slicing of Schwarzschild, and the color map is the lapse. Well, of course, the lapse is one everywhere, so it's purple, which is the top color here. And if you contrast that with the maximal slicing, then I'm showing this to you because we'll come back to it in the 2-black hole with maximal slicing. The lapse is going from purple, which it is out here, through blue down to red, which is very small. The white lines are where the horizon is, the intersection of the null surface with the 3 geometry. And you can see this infinite cylinder, well, it's this beginning of what would become an infinite cylinder as you go to the limit occurs. So this kind of, this is an isometric embedding of the geometry, and this is exactly what happens to each of the throats in the 2-black hole problem. So if you compare and contrast the 1-black hole with the 2-black hole, you'll find out that the initial data is essentially identical. It's conformally flat and time symmetric. There's a constraint equation that leads to the familiar 1 plus m over 2r to the fourth sitting outside of the isotropic coordinates for Schwarzschild in the 3 surface. And then here are the Misner-matched coordinates for the 2-black hole problem. In this case, you only have the total mass. Here, of course, you have a dimensionless ratio of the proper distance between the initial minimal surfaces of the throats versus the total mass at infinity. Notice that here, if you went back a couple of things to the t equals zero, the event horizon and the minimal surface at t equals zero are coincident, 2 spheres. Whereas here, the minimal surface is inside the apparent horizon, although, of course, on the initial surface, we don't know where the event horizon is. We have to actually go through and throw the light rays through the space-time to figure that out later. So this is actually more general, so that when we connect our boundary conditions at the throat, that means they're inside the actual black hole. And then the lapse function, of course, as I said, you can either do symmetric or anisymmetric, but effectively, the space-time metric, here you've got 2 functions in the space metric, I call it A and B, and here you've got 4. So from a computer point of view, it's not much more complicated to do the 2-black hole than the 1-black hole in terms of the variables that are involved in the number of equations. For some reason, I have a problem when I get to this slide. It probably is because I'm using Windows 2000 in beta form. Okay, so Now, that's the end of the first part of the lecture, which is really the conceptual framework that led up to the roughing out of the space-time. Now, in the roughing out of the space-time, we went through three runs for different values of mu. Now, mu is this parameter. So it's the parameter that spans these different initial data sets. So you could have said that the dimensionless parameter is the length between the throats divided by the mass. But the way that you actually write the analytic three metric down, there's this thing called mu zero that you use. And then L over M is a function of mu zero, and M is a function of mu zero, and so forth. As we'll see in a minute, by making it mu small, you effectively have a situation where the event horizon has already formed around the two throats at t equals zero, and so what you have effectively is the evolution of a highly distorted single black hole. We did that, of course, because life's hard, and you'd like to first of all understand what happens in the final state of the ring down of the collision before you get more ambitious, back the holes off, and then actually have to deal with the equation of motion effects of the holes coming toward each other, right? So what we did is we took three initial data sets to make evolutions from that would span the behavior, the physical behavior of the system, from a highly distorted black hole to two well-separated holes that fall together and form a single black hole. So I'll come back several times to this 1, 2, and 3. Or remember, 2, 2 3/4, and 3 1/4. Okay, now, of course, we were in complete la-la land. I mean, we had no idea when we would get results whether they were accurate or not, because we, of course, kept finding problems in the code, and then we'd find different approximations for the finite elements, finite differencing techniques. And so we had to have some way to calibrate, were we getting good physics out? Because, I mean, people had no idea how much radiation was going to come off of this thing. Was it 10 to the minus 4, or was it, 20%? And so and that's a very derivative quantity. So I'm going to take you through these ways that we were able to calibrate our work, many of which are still used today. Again, I'll just briefly point out, you can derive both the Misner coordinates that label the points in the three space, or the Chavez coordinates by doing a complex conformal map, which is, these are the equations of four up here. But effectively, physically, the way to think about it is you want the equipotential surfaces and the field lines for two electric charges. Either they're both the same charge, or one is positive and one is negative. And those equipotential surfaces and field lines are the two coordinate systems. Okay? And so this one is much better for numerical calculation because at far distances it acts like a spherical one black hole coordinate system. Down near each of the throats where you have to put the boundary conditions, it acts like a nice spherical system. But you got to pay for that by a singularity in the coordinates that occurs, not a physical singularity, but a singularity in the coordinate system that you'd have in flat space by spherical coordinates at the saddle point. So a great deal of our problem was at the saddle points. And since this is the equipotential surfaces for two like charges, and think of them as repelling in the center, you can see here that there's also a tendency for the lines to stay away from the saddle point and thereby to give larger errors in the discretization of the three space at that point. Now, what's important to remember is in the computer, of course, you have just I and J. So you have a rectilinear set of points on which you're going to hold all of the metric variables and extrinsic curvature and laps and so forth. And so notice that the saddle point is actually at some random point, so many grid points up, which is how many grid points over here you happen to choose. And so one of the parameters was how many lines of grid points do you put between the edge of the throat and the saddle point, and then how many do you put out here? And since you can only have so much memory, a lot of the tactics about these early problems in which we were barely able to get through the solution. So you had to think a lot about conserving space in the computer and all kinds of stuff you don't think about so much anymore. And so where you put that point made a lot of difference. it's actually a little more complicated than this. What by splitting up the conformal transformation, you can make it so that you can actually have a non-uniform angular set, so that you can put more lines over here because the waves are going to come out here and there's not much that's going to go on the axis. And similarly, you can do the radial part separately in the conformal transformation and get more points down here than you do out there. But that's sort of a detail. Okay, how did we know by looking at the three metric that we were getting something that was remotely right? Well, as I showed you, the form of the metric, the three space, for the two black holes and the one black hole were very similar, and they both just had the lap sitting there for G00. So what we would do is take the Schwarzschild, this is from Epley's thesis, we'd take the Schwarzschild, so this is space here, the thing is, starts off with, say, alpha equal 1 up here, and then with time, the collapse of the lapse occurs at the center point, remember, which is at the throat, and then comes back out to a boundary condition of 1 and infinity. And then these, because it's a Schwarzschild, we could look, and remember I showed you that the slices went through where the event horizon was, so we could find where on the lapse the event horizon was, and you can see it's essentially at the inflection point. And so we would know to look at the lapse function and say, well, near the inflection point is probably where the event horizon are. Furthermore, remember when I showed you the thing that showed the isometric embedding diagram for the maximal slicing, you can see that there's a radiometric stretch that goes on, and here is where the event horizon is. This is the conformal radiometric, and you can see that this event horizon is right outside the point of maximum peak in the metric function. Well, that's because the inside along the throat, the lapse is zero, so time is frozen, so you don't have more radiometrics coming down there. Right outside, it's trying to stay away from the hole, so the maximum stretching is right across the event horizon where you go, you know, where the metric goes from just what it was before down to match that cylinder. So these models were in our heads, very much malice aforethought, when we then looked at the evolution of the two black holes. So here now are the evolutions of the lapse functions for for the closest in case of the already merged, and I've shown with a white line here, roughly speaking, where we think the event horizon was. And this is without using null geodesics. This is just using these kind of qualitative arguments I just went through. And here it is for the two very far away. The outer boundary is about 40 m. And so this is just the innermost part of the grid. The outer boundary here is about 6 m, and here is about 11 m. And this is the axis of symmetry. This is the equatorial plane here. And these were movies. In fact, these were some of the first color movies with scientific visualization that were made, because this was at Livermore. Color 16 millimeter film had just come to the lab. And we were actually using it before the bomb guys were, in most cases. So I'll start both of these, and they're roughly coincident in time. That is, the time steps are about the same on both of these. So what you can see is right away for the already merged one, you get this collapse of the lapse in the center region. And essentially now this is one black hole, one spherical black hole, and now you see the grid sucking pulling down into here. Whereas the holes are now, quote unquote, moving together. That means that the proper metric of the separation is decreasing. But you notice that it's collapsing around each black hole separately as the holes essentially move together. And then only after the event horizon then begins to form around them do you find the collapse of the lapse in the center region. So by just looking at things like the lapse function, you could already work out the qualitative physical story. Now, so here then is how it changes with the parameters changing. So this is the already merged case, run one, the sort of separated but just barely case, and this is the far separated case. And this is t equal 10m, 20m, and 30m, so absolute amount of time from the initial data forward into the future. And what you can see here is very quickly the collapse in the center region, meaning that they were, since you can see, they were essentially already merged. Here, there's a just barely beginning to be a bit of collapse before they come together. And here you have a completely separate evolution of each hole for quite a while before they actually get close enough to each other to begin the merging process. So now you can see the same thing. I hate beta operating systems. You can see the same thing for the radial metric. So now again, the outer metric is about, the outer grid here is about 6M. And so this is the conformal metric, that is, it's one everywhere, because the conformal factor is what has the gravitation of the two black hole throats. And you can see, as the hole comes in, there's this bulge, and then as it forms through merger, and a bulge over here on the equator, here on the axis. And then notice, compared to just what we had in the one black hole, this is the rough estimate of where the event horizon would be. So all of these grid points effectively are now inside, and these are outside. But of course, this is a small fraction of the total grid. Again, if you compare the three different runs, you can see this phenomenon of the already merged event horizon. Even though the apparent horizons are quite separate at t equals zero, effectively the system acts like a single large distorted hole, whereas down here you can see the bulge you see around each hole quite separately. Of course, obviously there's a mirror image of the other hole on the other side. I don't know why this keeps doing this. Okay. So one of the other things we tried to do then was to embed the isometrically, like the ones I showed you for the single black hole. This is a pretty difficult problem, and I spent a lot of time on this. It's basically a numerically unstable problem to embed things. There's a lot of stuff on embedding soap films and all kinds of things that mathematicians do. We've studied all that literature. We've got all of the minimal equations and so forth to do it. Chavez and his thesis was able to do it, that is, taking the three metric at each of the grid points, which is what you have, and then from that, calculating in a flat three space what would be the isometric embedding of that two-dimensional slice. Because it's axisymmetry, you only need two dimensions. But he did it for very large mu, where they were far enough away that you didn't really have the strong field. Epley and I didn't have that luxury because we were dealing with it close, so we went to a more practical technique. We would actually take each of the grid strips. For each grid square, we would take the three metric and calculate the proper square. So we would calculate the sides and the angles of the square. And then we used a CalComp plotter to plot each of the strips out in both directions with the proper squares. We cut them out with scissors, and then we wove them together, and with Scotch tape tied them up. And you could then begin to get the evolution of the initial data. And you can see, again, the throats beginning to, the proper distance beginning to come in here. So at that point, we had a pretty good physical model of an understanding of the what you might call the longitudinal components of the gravitational field, the Newtonian components. But the gravitational radiation was way more difficult to calculate, very much more difficult, because what you're essentially going for is things like psi 4, which are Riemann tensor components, and so you're looking at two more spatial derivatives of the three metric, and since it's radiation and it will propagate, you're looking for a cancellation between the time derivatives and the spatial derivatives as well. And so each of those takes whatever errors that you have in the finite approximation for the continuous three space that your particular code technique developed and amplifies them. But fortunately, there were a lot of very smart people who had been working on the gravitational radiation problem generally that we could work on. Now, there was the time-symmetric gravitational wave problem was really very important to us, and that enabled us to really look at a full 3-space, both in flat and very strong cases, and evolve gravitational radiation. Bill Press, as a first-year graduate student, I guess, figured out that black holes had normal modes, and then following up some of the work of Zirilli and Wheeler and so forth, Davis and Ruffini in one group and Press and Price in the other group were able to look at then exciting that black hole in a very specific way by dropping a particle radially inward and then finding the normal modes that came out, and those, of course, were very critical for the two black hole. Hawking and his collaborators looked at these upper limits on radiation from two black holes dropped from infinity, and then Gibbons and Bernie Schutz and Andre Chavez were able to say, okay, if the holes start off at rest and bound, then you're going to get less out. Saul Tikalsky, I don't know how much Saul remembers this, but Saul did an analytic version of a Brill wave, effectively, a weak Brill wave. And that was very useful. I was just going through my Wheelerian notebook, which we all were taught how to keep in those days, for the 1977 runs, and I have Saul's linearized wave, which we used to evaluate not only our code, but we also had to figure out which method would you like to use to measure the gravitational radiation, there being at least a dozen different proposed methods. And so we were... That's correct. So that, I have pages last night at the Elephant Restaurant here. I was sitting there waiting, you know, working with her ribs on one hand and going through my notebook on the other hand and remembering that. Anyway, then that enabled us to basically not only verify the code, which meant making millions of changes over, you know, years, but also figuring out which of the various radiation techniques actually would be more accurate. So to give you an example, here is the Brill wave, and again, you have this conformal factor out front, but it's not conformally flat. There's a blob of radiation there. I mean, as I said earlier, Jimmy reminded us about the conformal three-metric being the carrier of the gravitational waves, so if you've got pure gravitational waves, you'd expect there to be something in the conformal three-metric, and it's this exponential a to the q. A is the amplitude, effectively. Of course, naturally, there's an elliptic equation for the conformal factor, and then this q here also turns out to be the source function when it has two spatial derivatives for the conformal factor. So if you make a very small, like, say, a part in a thousand, then you this is the result of the numerical calculation of the Brill wave for a weak Brill wave, and this is over here psi 4, and you can see this very beautiful waveform going out along the equator. Now here you can see in the arrows something called the Bell-Robinson pointing flux, which is something that I was a champion of in those days as a way to find out where gravitational radiation is in your 3-grid. Took a lot of abuse for that because everybody said it really wasn't, you know, energy or a pointing vector or something, and but it was very clear from these sort of tests that while it may not be, strictly speaking, a momentum, it sure is good at telling you where there's radiation. So we used every trick in the book. Again, this is slightly outside of my 1985 cutoff. This is from Andrew Abrams, who I wish were here for this workshop, who's, of course, now very high up in J.P. Morgan. And this is the center lapse for a strong Brill wave, where now the amplitude, instead of being a part in a thousand, so that was, say, 1 in these units, here it's 17 and here's 26, if you like. And here you can see the time-symmetric waves at the beginning. So you've got waves coming in, waves going out in space-time. At the beginning, there's a lump of gravitational radiation, which is almost strong enough to cause the lapse to collapse to zero and therefore form a black hole. If you make the lapse a little bit bigger, then the central value of the lapse over time oscillates just like it's, you see, these are sort of the same up to there. But then the difference is this then finds a way to get back out to infinity, and here it collapses and forms a hole. So here you had very strong field, highly dynamic, three space, so that this was a laboratory that we could use to evaluate gravitational radiation detectors and to understand in the problem that we had, in which you had these strong longitudinal fields, very strong because of these topological throats, and in that same three space gravitational radiation, you had to be able to tune your things to both. So, you know, I've just taken you through what we did with the throats. Now we're doing the same thing with the waves, because you had a mixture, fundamental mixture of the two, that really couldn't be split out. Okay, now, how much radiation will there be? At Les Ouches, of course, we were all very excited when Hawking showed that using the area theorems, he could show that as much as 30% of the rest mass energy might be radiated away for two Schwarzschild black holes dropped toward each other. Now, of course, his area theorems include the spiraling in case, and we're not able to really differentiate between the head-on case and the spiraling case. But these are bound holes. So actually, for mu equals 2, Bernie sitting over there, and Gibbons and Chavez were able to show that you're actually getting a more modest, like 5% mc squared is an upper limit. There are a number of people that did this and said, well, let's just imagine two point particles in Newton's theory of gravity using Newton's law of equation, Newton's law of motion, and let them come until there's a cutoff, because all the radiation gets admitted, of course, in the time-changing quadrupole moment of these two particles when they're very close together, because they're falling near the speed of light, they're coming in very close, and they have a very high rate of time change of quadrupole moment. So let's cut off the emission when they're 2m apart, where m is the total mass. Well, then it turns out that it scales as if m is the reduced mass and big M is the total mass, that you get something in the range of half a percent to 2% times this combination. And so when you put in the total mass being 2 and the reduced mass being a half, you get 0.0003 up to 0.0001. If you have equal masses. Now, I included a redshift factor in here, which, you know, isn't 1 minus something m over r, and that something could be, you know, 0, 1, or 2, or whatever. And that uncertainty in how to represent the redshift is the range. But you can see around it, you're getting something about 0.001. Now, if you took drip, you'll notice that, this is Davis, Raffini, Press, and Price, you'll notice that the scaling factors here, where M is the little mass and big M is the mass of the black hole, are just the same as the shape of the scaling factors here in the Newtonian calculation. So the obvious thing to do there is to say, well, let's just let little m, even though it's, you can't obviously scale up a perturbation calculation like that, be the reduced mass and M be the total mass, and guess what? You get a number that falls exactly almost in the same ballpark as the Newtonian. So we knew all of this before we'd done the calculation, and what we were all, the community was hoping, for those who wanted a lot of gravity waves out of this, is that somehow magically, and Charlie Misner and I had a lot of wonderful conversations about whether this magic would happen or not, somehow magically the non-linear strong field dynamics, Kip used to always say this, you know, great big question mark, the strong field dynamics would somehow magically produce a bunch of gravity waves as the horizons came together and saved the day, and general relativity would be much better than Newtonian theory at producing gravity waves. And of course, that's not true. But that's the state of mind we were all in. And so as you'll see, our numbers with a full black hole collision came out to be as almost identical to what you would have produced by just the Newtonian estimate. Now, to get at some of these area limits, you had to think about the difference between the apparent horizon and the event horizon. And in Bernie and Gibbons' work, they were, this is from that paper, you had these different types where you would have an event horizon around the initial apparent horizons, because the apparent horizons, of course, could be found in three surfaces. The event horizons couldn't. Or whether you had something which, and Roland Lindquist had shown, if you get this as the holes come together, a new minimal surface will form essentially surrounding the two original minimal surfaces as you have over here. This is sort of for those of you who want to see it 3D. So here's the, for my thesis, here is the efficiency of radiation as a percentage of the total mass. 30% up here, of course, is where Hawking in 71, his limit was. This is as a function of the separation. So here the holes are very far apart. Here they're very close together, and down here is the mu value. So here's the down here where the bound holes are the curve that Gibbons and Schutz and then Chavez was actually able to determine where, for what values of mu, these holes were already bound, and so probably the curve looks something more like that. And for the various values of mu from 2 to 3.75, this is the regime then that Epley and I were investigating. Now, one of the things was, how long do you have to evolve this system? Because evolving it for a long time was hard, took a lot of computer time, but also the code wouldn't hold together. It'd start going unstable and things. So here, again, were the three runs. This is mu this way, and this is the amount of time in m that you went through to the future. And there were just various ways of figuring this out. So here's how L over m, used in those terms over there, varied versus the various values of u. These are collapse times. So this is, if we looked at the collapse of the lapse, if we looked at the bulge in the radiometric function, we could sort of get an idea of when those would occur. So in other words, for this run, this is, you know, at 15m where the lapse collapses in the center, okay? And up here is the actual final amount of time that we ran. So here, at these values of t, are where the strong field stuff is happening in the middle, and here's how long we ran for those three runs. So you can see we run many light crossing times, effectively, of the strong field region. Okay, well, what came out? And here's the actual, just like we saw before, here's the psi 4 of the two black holes. This is the outer boundary here is at 40m. I've cut out the center just to make it easier to see. And the radiation to sphere is at 25m. And here you can see the psi 4 heading out. If you look along the equator, here's the actual psi 4 as a function of space. So here's in near the holes, here's out at 40m at the edge. And you can see this characteristic waveform starting. And now if you just sit on the radiation to sphere at 25m and you watch the angular pattern, as it comes out. So that would be looking at this angular pattern, but just on the two-sphere. This is essentially the antenna pattern. I've made this logarithmic in the actual flux going through the two-sphere. And so you can see as the first large pulse comes out, it's a characteristic, beautiful quadrupole pattern. And then it goes through octupole, back to quadrupole, octupole, back to quadrupole, and so forth. So you saw that the energy was going out, but because it's logarithmic, the quadrupoles are smaller, so they're logarithmically smaller. And of course, that's what we found in the drip calculation of the single particle falling into the hole, and as we found later on, and here's the comparison with the actual final case, to be the case for the two black hole. So here's what Epley and I found. This is psi 4 as a function of time, basically retarded time. And this is the waveform we got with an amplitude of about 0.003 in these units. And here's the same quantity from the perturbation, the drip perturbation calculation of a single particle, small particle dropped into a black hole. So we knew that we had found basically that there was the same physics going on in the two black holes coming together as a small particle dropping in, namely, you excited quasi-normal modes, and they radiated, okay? That there was essentially no other physics. Here is then from the 93 paper where this was done much more accurately, but the same exact problem, black hole problem. And here they're calculating the L equal 2 mode at two different distances, and you can see that it's propagating at the speed of light. But if you compare this and this, you can see they're virtually the same. And then here's the octupole, the L equal 4. And again, you can see if you look carefully, this is 0.2, and this is 4 times 10 to the minus 3, and so logarithmically smaller was the quadrupole. The octupole was logarithmically smaller in energy than the quadrupole. So we're almost done. So what about comparing it with those area theorems? Here then from the 93 PhysRev letter that Aninos and the rest of us did is the energy logarithmically, and here is the Gibbons-Schutz line, here's the Hawking line. These X's with our factor of two error bars are the three runs that Epley and I made, and then the small dots, these are the actual runs then that were done by Aninos and Hobel, and Seidel was just starting with us at that point. And then here's one of the first semi-analytic estimates, taking the Newtonian thing and thinking about tidal radiation and thinking about some of it went down the hole and making estimates, and we could get this. And here's the level that you would have had by just taking drip and scaling it up with the reduced mass and total mass. So you know, it basically made a consistent story. And of course, the nice thing is that this is, of course, still terra incognita for the spiraling collision, because we don't know how far up. I mean, this is the lower limit for what's going to come out, but what we don't know and what this workshop is primarily about is how much can we get of that region. Then I went out to Utah to visit Richard Price, and I had had a long idea since the beginning that since it was such good comparison between the drip calculation and this calculation, it was clear that nothing really other than perturbation was going on here for gravitational waves. I wasn't a perturbative type of physicist. I didn't do that stuff. So I suggested to Richard that he think about a more general kind of perturbation theory based around, say, the three spaces and so forth, that would let you analytically, effectively, or in perturbation theory, calculate the two black hole collision. And so a group of folks, Price and a bunch of his students later on, and then working with our group at Illinois, got two different approaches, one using the membrane paradigm, which we may hear about some more here, that Kip Thorne and a lot of his students developed, and then the other one was using this perturbation. And so these dots here are the numerical calculation of various values of mu for the two black hole that were done after Epley and I did it. And then these are the analytic estimates. So after the whole thing was all said and done, you, in fact, could use perturbation theory to calculate the gravitational radiation from the two black holes without having to do the evolution. But, of course, you would have never done that if you hadn't done it. So one of the areas that I thought was very interesting, very complex from a theoretical point of view, that was kind of a scrap left on the table after I stopped working on this, was, okay, so how do you actually generate the gravitational waves in the strong region and get them out to infinity? Because in electromagnetism, we know all about that. You take electric charge distribution and you shake it, and there's an induction zone, a near zone, and then some of it, the transverse traceless part of the field, shakes off. And or the transverse part that shakes off, and in gravity that would be the transverse traceless part, and goes out to infinity. But we don't have a model like that, and we know one reason for it is that we can't locally define gravitational radiation or gravitational energy. On the other hand, it was very clear looking at the numerical output that if you looked at it by radial zone number, which since we had essentially a logarithmic radial coordinate system, and you looked at the log of something like the Bell-Robinson vector, or psi 4, whatever, you could see up here in the ringing zone, you could see the wavelets being born. And they would hang in this sort of, you know, this what we now know as this potential region around 3M, And then they would one by one fall down this barrier and then just head out. But you could see them all being born perfectly well at 3M. Okay? But what were the tools to really turn that into something better? So let me show you numerically, and then I'm almost done. This is the actual grid we used for the run. And I think this is mu equals 2. It was actually quite fine, if you think about it, for those days. And then this is the contours. We're talking about the edge out here at about 40 m. Okay, these are contours of the logarithm of the radial Bell-Robinson vector. The Bell-Robinson vector is essentially the Riemann tensor squared projected with the normal vectors to the 3 surface to give a pointing-like single index quantity. And what you can see down here is there's 3 things that it shows you going on. The region out here along the equator is quadrupolar waves being formed and going out. Here, you have inward-pointing curvature, which is essentially the grid sucking going down inside the horizon. And then you can see this, which is a numerical error that pestered us all the way through our calculation on the axis, which is an instability effect that occurs on the z-axis. But this is just to show you that this whole business of creating the waves here in the strong field region and letting them go out to infinity was very clearly going on, and there's been a lot of papers since then that have gone in to try to understand better how that works. So the one last thing I'll show you of a numerical calculation, and again, this is just a couple of years over my limit of 1985, was we found an initial data set of the Brill waves and the single black hole. And so we could take mixtures, admixtures of gravitational waves around a single black hole, but with full nonlinear theory. And you can see again down here, if you look in this region, this is an isometric embedding diagram, you see the waves being formed, you see them being trapped in alternating colors down the throat, so part of the wave goes down the throat, part of it goes out. And so this Bernstein was got his PhD on this sort of stuff, provided a way to really study that problem. So where are we then from 95 till now? Well, that's the story I'm not going to tell you. That's what you're going to be talking about primarily. But the one thing that I found in going through this review is how it always seems so close. So here in 1987, you know, 72, we're going to have gravity waves by Christmas. That was the rally and cry. So Kip, in a very wonderful, detailed essay that he wrote for this 300 Years of Gravitation volume, says that numerical relativity is going to give us a detailed and highly reliable picture of the final coalescence and the waveforms they produce for completely general spiraling in, you know, spinning vectors at angles to the orbital angular momentum within the next 5 years. Well, that would have been by 1992. We're not there yet. And so I think that this is one of the very interesting things about this problem is that there's this sort of endless regress that goes on. Some of the things, I'll just do 2 more slides and we'll be done, that things that were very clear to us that were needed to be worked on, but we didn't get far enough to get worked on, and there's a lot of articles by many of you since then, in 1985, we still had to do. The strong Brill wave collapse was barely possible. It wasn't anchored by the throat, and so numerically it was actually much harder to do a strong Brill wave collapse to a black hole than it was to do the ones that the throats were already there. In just the axisymmetric case itself, everything we did was equal mass. What about unequal mass? Jacob Bekenstein had shown that if you have unequal mass, of course you radiate linear momentum, so that there's a whole nother component to the radiation problem that we never looked at, which was the radiation linear momentum. We chose conformally flat time symmetric slices. That is weird from a physical point of view because it's not what you'd really like to control the gravitational radiation that's sitting in the initial slice, if you like. You'd like there to be a KIJ, and there were, of course, been papers since then to do that, and also the conformal piece of it would have something to do with that as well. I, for instance, had done a lot of work on the Kerr metric, and I knew at the time that the three metric for the Kerr was not conformally flat, that when you had spin angular momentum, even though there wasn't radiation, there was a longitudinal component of the conformal three space that was there. So it was pretty clear you couldn't have two spinning black holes, you know, axisymmetric and have a conformal three surface, three space that would be realistically like the Kerr. I did a lot of work, in fact, did an abstract, a short paper to the American Physical Society on the boosted case, and we really didn't get started but talked a lot about the rotating case. In particular, Bryce DeWitt coined the term the cosmic screw for the case where the spin is equal and opposite of the two holes. So when they come together, two, say, nearly extreme Kerr holes, and when they come together, it's Schwarzschild. And somehow, as it comes together, all that enormous amount of dragging of inertial frames and energy in the angular spin angular momentum has to be converted into gravitational radiation, and that ought to be some real fireworks. So we talked a lot about that. We just started on this. And then again, this approximation techniques of not having to actually do the full calculation were in the future. For the non-axisymmetric case, it was wide open. We talked a lot about the coordinate systems you use and so forth, speculated basically a lot about that. And what might happen. And then there was a whole bunch of technologies, both analytic technologies and numerical technologies. For instance, the whole problem of equation of motion is fundamental to the theory. I won't talk about that, but I think we're going to have some talks about it. Very important problem we really didn't do much with. Maximal slicing had all these problems associated with it, not the least of which was the bulge in the metric function that was caused by the sucking of the grid. And could we find shift vectors that would actually be useful? And you had to worry about the boundary conditions at the throat because it wasn't obvious. If it's not zero, you're shooting up coordinates from this imaginary universe down below. So how does that work? Adaptive grids. Matt Chaptewick was, of course, a real pioneer in helping us understand that adaptive grids would enable us to both have fine resolution wherever you needed it in the various functions, at the same time be able to cover the whole problem. We could do a little bit of work on where the apparent horizons were. We talked about, you know, when we had this space-time lattice, scattering null rays through the space-time lattice to find out where the event horizons were, but we really were never able to implement it. Characterizing the full characterization of the gravitational waves, particularly when you had both odd and even parity. I'll talk a little bit about that in my physics colloquium tomorrow. Much better visualization techniques, and then the whole notion of community codes, where CACTUS has now arisen as something that's probably one of the most important things going on today, is a very powerful, fully functional code that anyone in the community can use to solve Einstein equations. That everything we did was really not transferable in that sense. So that was still to come. So I'll just end with where we started. It's a wonderful problem. It's humbling to think how long we've been at it, and we're still not done. We're actually quite a ways from being done in a sense that we really have accurate physics coming out. So I think that this problem is going to keep us well occupied as relativists for at least another couple of decades. Thanks.
Questions? Comments?
Bev. Technology question, not question, comment. You should comment, and it's apparent in your thought, that the development of visualization techniques and other methods of actually looking at the data have also followed the growth of computer power.
Right.
In the old days, it took you forever to do the simplest kind of graph.
Yes, I wrote all the graphics routines for everything you saw, and it was lift pin, move pin, drop pin were the fundamental commands. In fact, many people in numerical relativity still use my subroutines that do these three-dimensional plots of the metric functions and so forth. I remember Bill Press, who I wish was here, saying at one point after I'd given 200 talks, by rough account, on the two black hole problem, he said, you know, Larry, none of us ever understood what we were seeing with those visualizations you did of those squirrely sort of birdcage things. I mean, it was, you know, part of the problem was what is intuitive in terms of visualization for one person isn't necessarily the same for another person. We had nothing but dumb terminals. There were no personal computers. In fact, my first movies were that I sent. I remember Stephen Hawking getting these in Cambridge, and he said it was a 16-millimeter film of a Tektronix screen, and so it was bright green on dark green line graphics. And I remember he said they somehow in Cambridge University, I can't believe they actually found one, but they found a 16-millimeter movie projector, and they played the film, and they had no idea what they were looking at. And they played it forward and backward and so forth, and it didn't seem to make any difference. So, but yeah, the visualization technologies today are just so far beyond anything we dreamed of having then. I don't think we use them very well yet. I mean, I think that's a real, you know, we've made a lot of progress, particularly like in the grazing condition. Wima will show you of the spiraling, and I'll show a movie from that tomorrow in my colloquium, but it's a long way to go.
I guess we'll take about a 10-minute break.
I'm sorry, Bob, I'm running into your time. Right. For which one? No, that started in the 40s. Started in the 1940s. So this is 1940. Right. Right. Yeah, they're earlier, but they aren't really. I think they're microprocessors, but they're specialized microprocessors. They weren't widely used. I mean, the i860 wasn't used by anybody other than Intel that made supercomputers. Yeah, I just should have put mass market in front of it. But.
Nice talk. Really,
thanks.
I enjoyed it in my lab. Quite good, actually. In fact, I want to ask you, I'll get them some other time if I can see, report from the chapter.
I've got it with me.
Yeah.
Right. It's hard to come by.
Yeah.
It was just so clear.
I was wondering if you plotted the number of papers in America relative or the people working there.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of plateau, because that's how I remember things.
Yeah, exactly.
You stopped doing these things and worked on astrophysical fluids at around that time.
Jim,
hey.
Great to see you.
You haven't aged any. Is that because you've been in your computer center?
Keeps me young.
Hi. Jim Hartle, we've met before.
Sounds like one.
James Hartle, I'm not sure.
Yeah, he was, Bernie was just saying that if we plotted the number of people in the field or something, maybe we'd get this sort of pause, you know, in the 60s and 70s when there were just a fairly small number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still, you know, you had to get a top secret nuclear weapons clearance to get access to the supercomputers and so on. And then, you know, how is it? And also, you didn't have any jobs. I mean, it was impossible. All our guys got hired by Livermore Los Alamos after we got them PhDs.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right.
Who's writing the history of this? Right, because the participants, right, as we see around here, unlike, except for you, right, of course, you're getting older.
You're so kind, Jim.
Wouldn't be a bad idea to put it all back, right?
Well, that's why.
And you might get the IGP to do it. For example, we had a similar situation maybe 15 years ago with the Mass Matter visits, which was a much bigger area. But it was just the founders of the area were still around.
What we should do is talk to Matt and see whether they can't just take people off for an hour and record an oral statement of the people that are here that were then there. I mean, Charlie Misner, I mean, it's just wonderful that he's here, right? Mine was recorded because I assumed that this might turn out to be a useful exercise. So in principle, this thing...
Well, they record everything.
Right.